Hey everybody, welcome to Rock and Roll Shinsu Chew. This is episode 126. 1966 was a transition period for both baseball and popular music. Grass gave way to turf. Sunny pop gave way to psychedelia. America dug further into the Vietnam War, and the civil rights movement galvanized much of the country to push back against racism and address prejudice and discrimination head on. On the diamond, many baseball greats from the 1950s were nearing the end of their prime, making room for new stars and new digs as the year marked the opening of Busch Stadium and Angel Stadium, which would set the blueprint for the wave of new ballparks that would open over the next decade. Despite the trying times and political upheaval, it was a great year for baseball and music. Tonight, we'll cover the genres, players, and places that made it all happen. This is a field guide to 1966, and this is Rock and Roll Shinsu Chew. My name is Gabe Estel. I'm here with my co-hosts, Dennis Levi Leach and Jonathan Getz. How are you, fellas?
Amazing.
All right.
Glad to hear it. Good to be back. Very good year for music and baseball here. We're going to talk about baseball first, get into that. As I mentioned in the intro, I was researching this episode, I was looking at, I always look at, who won, how did the MVP race shake out and the Cy Young races. And you saw a lot of names, that are like these iconic players from the 1950s that were still putting up, they were still having good years, right? Like they started to fall a little bit further down the MVP list. I noticed people like Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, right? Sandy Koufax won the Cy Young that year. And I want to say it was his final season or near his final season.
Until
just pain took over. But it was kind of a little bit of a, would you guys say kind of a passing of the baton a little bit with baseball this year, right? I mean, you had players like Brooks Robinson really coming into their own. Pete Rose, right, was in the league at this point. So it seems like a little bit of a shift, right?
Yeah, a changing of the guard for sure.
Yeah, I think so. It was the first year. It was the World Series matchup was the Orioles and the Dodgers, and this marked the Orioles' first World Series victory, one of only two World Series victories for the franchise, and it really kind of was the start.
Three World Series victories.
They do have three, right? They had. I'm sorry. Yeah. Pardon me. Thank you. 1970, right? I think was the other one. Yeah. So 66, 70, and 83. Thank you for that. And, they would, after winning this World Series in 66, they would be, a really competitive franchise for about the next, dozen years or so. A little bit more than that, even actually. So, yeah. So great World Series teams. You have Frank Robinson, MVP. You have the other Robinson, no relation, Brooks Robinson.
If they had been around in the 80s, there would have been an awesome like Robinson and Robinson Esquire like poster where
absolutely.
They're like suits and stuff. Like
yeah. The copyrights itself. That, yeah.
That being said, it was 66, and there was a quote in the a terrific strain by Roger Angel to quote the story says the Robinson team, by contrast, posed arm in arm for the photographers, laughing and hamming it up. And when it was over, Frank Robinson, who is, of course, black, said to Brooks, who was born in Arkansas, if they print that down home, man, you'll never get back.
Oh, man. Frank seemed like such a cool dude, from just what I read about him. And I mean, as a kid growing up, we all knew him as a manager. Right. So I didn't really, get to experience him as a player. But it seemed like it was really exciting for him and Baltimore. Now he was baseball's best player that year, won the American League MVP, and he was also traded the year before. Cincinnati shipped him out. Jack Balchin, Milt Pappas, and Dick Simpson, right? Wasn't there a senator named Dick Simpson? Anyway, I don't know. But yeah, so obviously, I guess, Baltimore got the better end of that one.
Yeah, I think the Reds may have thought that Robinson's best years were behind him. He was set to turn 30 during the 66 season, and Reds owner Bill DeWitt referred to Frank as a, quote, not a young 30. And Susan Sarandon's character in Bull Durham even makes a reference to the how lopsided this trade was. And not only did he win the MVP in 66, he had two more top three MVP finishes in subsequent years for Baltimore. And in fact, he got even better in Baltimore in many ways. His OPS plus ballooned while he was there compared to his Cincinnati years.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mil Pappas actually, you know, had a pretty good career too, you know, with all due respect, you know, it was a pretty good pitcher. But yeah, not obviously the return for Cincinnati paled in comparison. This is not the Dick Simpson that was later a senator, I think. So okay. I'm just curious. I know if it was like a Jack Kemp type thing, but anyway.
Sure. Yeah, it's not out of the question.
yes, but no, it's not. But yeah, so you know, this is I don't know, it kind of also I would say, you know, Mike marks kind of the I want to say the arrival of Baltimore, you know, they became a powerhouse franchise for small market, but a powerhouse franchise for, you know, the next 15 years, essentially. One of the
I mean, they won a few World Series, they also lost a few World Series, which, hey, you know, you got to be in it to win it or lose it.
And, right.
So, hey, they still got still a pennant, right?
Yep. I think that, you know, in Baltimore, you know, nowadays, they thought that they were on the precipice of starting this over again with their current core. And it just shows how hard it is to make it happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. They've been here in 2026. A little bit of a disappointment this season for those following. You know, with we'll talk about the World Series because the Orioles swept the Dodgers in that World Series. And Jonathan, you know, there was kind of a Hank Bauer is the manager of the O's at that time,
and yeah, former New York Yankee,
right? And he made, you know, some pretty, a pretty big pitching change, right? During that, that game. We've got, Mo Dabrowski, right? I think got the win, that day, right? Dave McNally was taken out, and then Mo Dabrowski, ended up, getting the victory for game one. So, just kind of showed some managerial smarts there.
To yank your game one starter in the third inning.
Right.
Granted, he had walked five guys at that point and given up a couple earned, but the Orioles still had the lead when he yanked them. And then here's Dabrowski, goes 6 2/3 and strikes out 11 and doesn't give up any runs.
Right.
One hit. Yeah. Hell of a move.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also another thing that's interesting, right? This kind of ended the Yankees' dominance, right? I mean, the Orioles were the first American League team other than the Yankees to win the World Series since the 48 Cleveland team, right? And they were also the last of the original eight American League teams to win their first World Series title. So, yeah, it does mark not the start of the franchise, but certainly its arrival as a competitive force.
Yeah. We forget, we never knew what it was like for these original teams to struggle for so long and never get that championship. So it's interesting to see it put into context.
Yeah, absolutely. And Frank Robinson, you know, comes over to another league, right, and wins the MVP, his second in 6 years. So having a great career in Cincinnati, and then you know, he comes over to Baltimore, and you know, plays. Gosh, he's there for a good 6 years, six seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And he was great. And then, you know, also I have to admit, he played a long time. I mean, he played 20 seasons, right?
Yeah, 76.
Yeah, 56 to 76 he played. So he arrives in Cincinnati young, and then, you know, transitions to Baltimore in 66, and then, you know, bounces around a little bit, you know, once the 70s start. But, man, you know, just outstanding numbers from him this year. He hits .316. His OBP is .410. So that puts his slugging is .637. So his OPS is 1.047, right?
Yeah.
49 home runs, 22 RBIs, 122 RBIs, big difference there. And he leads the league in runs, right? Scores 122 runs. Leads the league in home runs, RBIs, leads the league in batting average, right? So he is also a Triple Crown winner this year, right? And his WAR, highest WAR too, in the game that year, it's 7.7 WAR.
His 198 OPS plus is nuts, because that suggests that he was basically twice league average in in OPS. He was twice as good as the average player, which is crazy.
He's just a pure stud in 66 and really, you know, the first half of his career as well. Like I said, he already had one MVP in 61 in Cincinnati. He's just killing it. So, and his whole time in Baltimore, he's one of the best players in the game. So really, really exciting time for him. And I kind of associate the guy as an Oriole. I have to admit, you know, maybe it's because of the managerial stint that came later, right?
With Cleveland.
Well,
I'm sorry, first with Cleveland, but then did he come back and manage Baltimore?
Yeah, I thought he did. Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And I want to say, was he one of the Nationals' first managers? Yeah. He was, right?
Yeah, good memory. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was the first ever African-American manager in the bigs.
Yes.
And he was a player manager in 74, at the end of 74, 75. Which it reminds me, that's why managers wear uniforms. Because it used to be that there were being a player manager with common, and you had to be ready to get in the game.
Right. I always remember that baseball card I had from like 85 or 86, and it said Pete Rose, first base - manager.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you're like, what?
It always kind of blew my mind. Right. It's just something that's be so unheard of today, you know? It was a neat time. And, you know, he's just great. He was also, if I'm not mistaken, right. So the American League MVP that year was Robinson, and the National League MVP was Clemente. So I think this is the first time baseball saw two MVPs of color, right? Wow. Like in one in each league, that I saw. I was doing some research here, and I think this is the first time that happened. Obviously, you had one or the other during previous seasons, mm-hmm. but which is a big deal. You know, it's 1966.
Yeah.
It is.
I did the civil rights for sure.
Yeah, you're in the throes of the civil mm-hmm. rights movement. So, you know, baseball at this point in 66, obviously, sure, you know, probably still had a long way to go, but you know, it is very integrated at this point.
Yeah.
And it was certainly kind of a groundbreaking year, as you had, you know, two non-white players capture mm-hmm. MVPs mm-hmm. in the respective leagues. So really cool.
And even Juan Marichal pitching for the Giants could have easily won the Cy Young that year. And he was a Dominican.
Yes. And then Wasn't that your? Were they only giving one Cy Young at the time too? That year,
correct. That was the last year of the single Cy Young award.
They didn't split. So Koufax gets it that year, and you know it's his last year, and you know, yeah. So if
Koufax was awesome too.
What was Frank Robinson's WAR again? Did you say that year?
7.7 that year. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is that on like Baseball Reference or?
I went to Baseball Reference.
That is Baseball Reference WAR. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And that might just be his batting WAR. I don't know if they include his fielding WAR or not.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about a man named Ron Santo. And he could be possibly the superstar that history forgot, because when I searched at Baseball Reference what Ron Santo's WAR was in 1966, it says it's 8.9.
Yeah, hell of a year.
Damn.
So everybody knows the household names of the 60s, Mays, Aaron, Clemente, Koufax, Banks. But if you ask a modern sabermetric nerd who the most underrated player of the decade was, Ron Santo is probably in the conversation. The biggest reason is, again, like I said, WAR. During his playing career, people looked almost exclusively at batting average, home runs, RBIs. But WAR, for layman's terms, rewards everything. Getting on base, drawing walks, playing premium defense, staying healthy, playing a difficult position. And Santo excelled at every one of those things. His six-year run from 1963 to 68 is pretty extraordinary. Year after year, he produced elite offensive numbers while playing outstanding defense at third base. But the Cubs weren't contenders, so nationally, he was overshadowed by players on all the winning clubs. Today, most analysts agree if he had played for the Dodgers or Giants or even the Cardinals, he would have been viewed probably very differently during his career in that time. And so 1966 is like arguably his peak. He hit 312, 30 homers, 114 RBIs, 41 doubles, and his on-base percentage was 412, which is like he was like an on-base machine before people even knew what that was or like cared about it or even. And so that's like the type of a season that any like front office today would be like, yes. Like, give us, like, five of those guys.
And yeah, here's a $300 million contract.
Well, yeah, and not, on top of it, I didn't even mention, oh, yeah, he's playing Gold Glove caliber defense at third base, and he's basically an MVP-level player all of those years.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, like, another layer onto his story is that he quietly managed type 1 diabetes throughout his whole career. Teams and players like him that had it didn't know because players feared it would cost them their jobs. And looking back, it's kind of remarkable to think that he maintained like durability and consistency under those circumstances, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
So did you guys know, like, I had no idea his 1966 season was that bonkers.
No,
I didn't know. Yeah, it was that good. I mean, I knew that that was him kind of
that's better than right, Clemente and Robinson if you're into WAR.
Yeah, and I misquoted the WAR. I mean, Baseball Reference had Robinson as the leader, but it must have just been the hitting, you know. I don't know. American League WAR. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, just a hell of a year. And he does get overlooked amid all those big names of his era.
Well, and
I'll
say, you know, one thing that happened was a lot of like the writers back then, I guess, didn't like him because they thought he was kind of like a young punk or like especially like the 69 Cubs when he would like, if the Cubs would win, he would like click his heels when they would run off the field. And like happiness, you know?
Yeah.
And so there were like writers that apparently held that against him for years, that people said. And so he had to wait until he had already passed away to get elected into the Hall of Fame. And so he spurned them. The Hall of Fame like changed rules now and the way the Veterans Committee is and the way things are set up to where that can't happen again. So at least Ron Santo kind of helped change all that.
Sure.
Goes to show you baseball still had grumpy old farts even back then, right? None of that heel clicking, god damn it.
Do you guys think playing for mediocre teams should unfairly hurt Hall of Famers' reputations?
No, I think
they're individual accomplishments. You know, that's what we reward when you go into the Hall of Fame. So, no, I don't think so. I mean, we were just talking about this before we hit record, right? I mean, Cal Ripken didn't play for a lot of great Orioles teams, right? I mean, he won a World Series right out of the gate. And then after that, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I, you know, they had a few over 500 seasons, but I don't know. Did he even go to the playoffs after 83? I don't know if he did. Right.
Yeah, and actually today at work, we were talking about how Bobby Witt Jr. He has the numbers to win an MVP this year, but if the Royals finish last, will he lose votes because he was on a team that finished last? And realistically, do the Royals need to finish, say, third or fourth for him to have a good shot at an MVP? And is that fair?
Right, exactly. It's still happening today.
Yeah. But Ron Santo's next year was 9.8 WAR, and he finished fourth in MVP voting, which is ridiculous.
It's crazy that. Yeah.
Yeah.
He finishes 12th, for God's sakes. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And like Orlando Cepeda won unanimously with 6.8 WAR that next year. It's like, okay. Yeah. They didn't have WAR then, obviously, but yeah, they were attracted to these other numbers and not appreciating the whole of Ron Santo, like you said.
So the Cubs I wonder how many
players just like him kind of slip through the cracks. But yeah, sorry, Gabe. Mm-hmm.
Santo would be one of the big ones that did. Although I think, you know, he died about 15 years ago. Yeah, 2010. It seems like, you know, his people are starting to appreciate him more. You know, since then, right? He's in the Hall now, right?
He died in 2010, and they elected him in like a guilty vote in 2011,
which makes you think, like, if he would have continued living, right? If he would have gotten in as quickly. I mean, the Cubs were really bad that year, and I'm not just rubbing it in, Levi. Like, so there were the way the league was structured that year, you had 10 teams in each league, right? I believe, yeah. And you know, the Cubs finished 36 games back, right? Yeah. And the lineup, I mean, you still had, like, Billy Williams. Okay, Santo is 26. Billy Williams is 28. And he wasn't injured. Billy Williams played every game that year.
Yeah.
Santo played, you know, about every game. Ernie Banks played most games. He played 141 games. So, you know, bulk of the season. Ernie Banks was 35 at the time. And at that time, they would have moved him to, well, I guess he would have been moved to first base, right? Because he would have started out at short, right? And then I'm thinking by this era, they moved him to first, is my guess.
Yeah.
As he aged, you know? So yeah, they could have, you figure they should have been better, but I don't know. I guess
pitching, I'm assuming. I didn't dive into who their pitching staff was.
They had Fergie Jenkins, right? I mean, let's see here.
So I know Ellsworth, it was even back then, but you couldn't pitch every game.
Okay. Dick Ellsworth lost. He was one of their starters. He lost 22 games that year, right?
Yeah.
But his ERA was still under 4. So obviously he was just on a shitty offensive team. Right. Fergie Jenkins was only 23. So maybe he had a 3.3 WAR, 6-8 record. Maybe he hadn't totally found his groove yet.
He only started 12 games.
Yeah. They had Robin Roberts, who was, you know, really old at 39, relatively speaking.
Springfield Zone.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, Robin Roberts came in the league. He's still playing in 66. He started playing in 1948, right? Which just seems like, you know, old. That's only that's 18 years before, right? But you're like, God, he started playing in the 40s and he was still playing in like the mid to late 60s. You know? Yeah. It was Robert.
That was a bad pitching staff, man. That was a bad pitching staff.
Yeah. But yeah, the Orioles, you know, good for them. I think go ahead.
I did have one guy that I had to learn about. I wasn't familiar, and you know, just looking through the leaderboards, and I saw this J.R. Hart. I was like, who the heck is J.R. Hart? Jim Ray Hart. I had never heard of Jim Ray Hart, and that was just my own fault. And so I dug into him, and he was a third baseman and outfielder for the Giants, who played from 63 to 74. So this is like his fourth season. And in 66, he was basically in the middle of the peak of his career. And he finished with 6.5 WAR, hitting 33 home runs and 130 OPS plus. And in his career, he ended up with more than 1,000 hits, 170 home runs, 127 OPS plus. This is basically Chris Bryant at this point, you know, Chris Bryant up and down, obviously. But he was an all-star, three-time MVP vote getter, rookie of the year runner-up. And early in his career, I think he got plunked by Bob Gibson and, like, broke his arm. And so he lost some power probably from that. Yeah, probably. he battled alcoholism throughout his career, and it was kind of widely known. His teammate Willie Mays, at the time, even offered to like buy him a bottle every Sunday if he could just stay sober during the week, which just shows, you know, how rough of a time he was having battling alcoholism. And so it makes you wonder how good he could have been had he not essentially tied one hand behind his back for his entire career. But yeah, Jim Ray Hart.
Nice find. Yeah. Good stuff there. Speaking of Mays, right. You know, he was still putting up good numbers, right. At 66, even though he's, you know, nearing the end of his prime, he'd play a few more years, but so the All-Star game that year, guys, listen to the outfield. I don't know if this is like, I'm sure we could crunch the numbers, or I don't know, ChatGPT could crunch the numbers of, you know, who like the best All-Star outfield is of all time, right? Like the combined WAR or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. In terms of name recognition, the National League outfield for this year is Mays, Aaron, and Clemente. That's your starting outfield in 1966 for the National League. What the fuck? Yeah, right. So I don't know. I'd put those three up against about anybody. That's pretty dang good. You know, I don't know. I'm guessing that's in the conversation of best All-Star game outfields ever.
Yeah, I don't have to. I don't even need to know the numbers. It's like, yeah, that sounds right.
No, definitely. Yeah, good stuff. You know, one other thing you know, obviously being a White Sox fan, you know, Louis Aparicio is one of the names that, you know, storied White Sox player, Hall of Famer. He was on the 66 Orioles that year. So this is after his time with the White Sox. He had a pretty good year, you know. I often, you know, just associate him with the White Sox, and I kind of forget that he did play for some other teams. He had actually had two stints on the White Sox, and then he would return in 68 to the White Sox. But yeah, his 66 year was pretty good. He hit .276. Got a gold glove, right? At this point, he's 32. You know, was still getting on base at a decent clip. I mean, he was never a power hitter, so that really, those numbers don't necessarily matter.
Yeah, shortstops then weren't.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Another thing, too, about Louis Aparicio, I just want to, obviously, he's a White Sox, so I'm going to brag on him for a minute. That 56 to 64, guys, he leads the American League in stolen bases every single one of those seasons.
Jeez. Wow. That is a lot of black ink. Yeah, man.
Yeah, wow. Dude. Yeah.
Wow.
So that's 9 seasons. Yeah. Of leading the league in stolen bases. The speed started to drop off around this time of 66, at least the stolen base totals, you know, but still in the double digits for stolen bases for most of his career. And he finished 9th in MVP voting. And, you know, obviously, like, you know, Luis Aparicio is not a name that I think a lot of people outside of the White Sox fan base, even though he's a Hall of Famer, or, you know, baseball nerds from way back when recognize, you know, he's not a Ron Santo, even maybe in terms of name recognition, and certainly not, you know, a Willie Mays or Roberto Clemente or Mickey Mantle. But, you know, it's quite a career to celebrate. And he is Luis Aparicio right now. I don't know if you guys know this, guys. He's the oldest living member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. He is 94.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And awesome. Still with us.
Wow. So, wow.
I lived cool. in the time of Louis. So
that's right, yeah really cool, maybe just see. Walking around Chicago, just a block away from each other at times, maybe.
Absolutely. A great player, and I just think still putting up really good numbers in 66 as well, so
good
times for him. Hey, got a World Series ring out,
and from Venezuela, so shout out to Venezuela. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was part of, you know, that wave of non-white players, you know, that would would come in the league. So he's sort of a pioneer in that regard, too, at least one of the early players.
Absolutely.
Good stuff there. Always like to see somebody from my team really shine, even if they're not on my team this year. But yeah, it was a fun year for baseball. And, Juan Marichal, right? I mean, I guess we'll talk about him for a moment before we move over to music. First Dominican player and first foreign-born player, right, ever elected to the Hall of Fame. And he's 25-6 that year, right?
Yeah.
If I'm reading that correctly, with a 2.23 ERA. Jesus.
Right? Yeah. 25. Oh, yeah. He was shoving, as the kids say.
Absolutely. Yeah, 9.1 WAR, Jesus, that year. So yeah, just unreal numbers from him too, and really, really good Giants team that year too. You know, they were battling neck and neck with the Dodgers that year in 66. So good stuff. Let's transition here, guys, as it was a time of transitions to popular music. And man, there's a lot going on in 1960. Kind of landed on this year. Obviously, it's the 60-year anniversary of this year. A lot of the music that I listened to growing up, you know, all three of us, I think I can speak for all three of us here, were gravitated towards older music, either older music or Seattle when we were growing up. And this most of the stuff that was played kind of on the classic rock radio, you know, for those not familiar, the WYMGs of Springfield, you know, a lot of the music that we were listening to back as then came out after 1966. But when I dug into 1966, I think it's such a pivotal year for music, and it maybe doesn't get as much attention as 1967. Because, you know, 1967 has, you know, the Monterey Pop Festival and the Summer of Love, and really kind of psychedelia just kind of explodes, you know, in popular music. You know, everything looks like Laugh-In and shit, right, in 1967. Whereas 1966 is a little bit of a bridge between kind of like...
It's still, 66 is the powder keg cooking.
Exactly. Yeah, the sunny kind of... A lot of songs about surfing of the early 60s, right?
Still like a little bit of happy folkness.
Totally. Sunny afternoon, indeed.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the Beach Boys writing a lot of songs about surfing. They show us in 1966, so they can talk a lot more than just surfing, right? So it's such an important year. and a big transitional one. You know, there's it's a big time for some big bands that were already established, and them kind of, I think, you know, kind of transitioning to really the periods of some of their best, arguably best music. I mean, you have the Beach Boys, as I mentioned earlier, coming out with their landmark release, Pet Sounds. You know, which I don't know. You really you know, every time you see these best albums in music history or best albums in pop music history, we've got two of them that usually crack the top five, just released in this year, in Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys and of course Revolver by the Beatles. So it's quite a year, and we're going to talk about that now. So with you guys, right? I mean, what do you, let me hand it over to you before we, you know, start getting sort of album by album breakdown. Yeah. What stands out to you for this year? Jonathan, I'll start with you, and then maybe Levi, we can kick it over to you after that.
Yeah. So what stands out to me was how kind of unready the world was for this transition into psychedelia, and how you know, what was established with the Beatles and the Beach Boys was what a lot of people just wanted more of, and but the bands were changing, and artists and music critics alike didn't know what to think about it, or some of them were like, you know, straight up argumentative of it. You know, the opening excerpt Paul Williams for Crawdaddy wrote about Revolver: "This is a good album. I say that grudgingly, I'm afraid. It's hard to accept the simple truth that it is not reasonable to expect the Beatles to be 10 times better than anyone and than anyone else every time they open their mouths. It's a good album, but Rubber Soul was much, much better."
Which doesn't mean wrong. Don't be wrong. Rubber Soul's great. But yeah,
that's how he opens his his critique. And so from that to, you know, to musicians' reactions to, say, Pet Sounds, and guys, you know, even like Keith Moon is says, you know, there's nothing revolutionary in the album, I don't think. They're not so much a vocal group these days. And so it was like, oh, wow, this change. And I don't really like this change. And that's not to say everybody, you know, everybody was panning it. A lot of musicians and critics thoroughly enjoyed this stuff. But there was a lot of uncertainty
too. Yeah.
Well, yeah, for sure. I could see like both sides of how like Pet Sounds and other albums later, even from that era, like The Doors' Soft Parade was pretty you know, polarizing when it kind of came out with fans, to where some of the Beach Boys fans who were used to the surfing and the vocals and the harmonies and stuff, and the songs just about, you know, not girls and like life and God only knows and deep, you know, where that, I'm sure that was like all new and craziness for a lot of people. But yeah, that year was so crazy in one aspect of a lot of white males discovering the blues of black artists and reinterpreting it all. It was like exploded. It was like the explosion of white boy blues in 1966. And everyone celebrates Pet Sounds and Revolver. And then one we haven't mentioned yet is Blonde on Blonde. Dylan's one of his best albums is in 1966.
But he's electric at this point.
Yeah.
You know, right. So.
But 1966 was also the year, you know, electric blues finally took its step towards hard rock and becoming what it would be the 70s. And so the Rolling Stones' aftermath is kind of where they truly became songwriters, and instead of simply great interpreters of American blues songs, Jagger and Richards delivered an entire album of originals that was darker and more sarcastic and adventurous than anything they had done before, really. So that was kind of new for them. And then At the same time, though, John Mayall's Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton, the famous Beano album. I don't know. Did you guys have that when we were growing up? Did you know that album? And okay. It's a famous John Mayall blues record. And so
it's, on that, it's got all four of them sitting down.
It's all four of them. Yeah, John McVie before Fleetwood Mac was the bass player. So it's John Mayall, John McVie, and Eric Clapton. And so Eric Clapton's reading a comic book, and the name of the comics were Beano. And so people call it the Beano album.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically that was the first time that Clapton had ever took a Les Paul and cranked it through a Marshall. And that became like the blueprint for British blues rock, like Jimmy Page, Peter Green, Jeff Beck, like countless other people were like, okay, Les Paul's with Marshalls. This is where it's at. And so Clapton is so, you know, wanted as a guitarist that he doesn't even stick with Mayall for the whole year. And by the end of the year, Fresh Cream comes out with Clapton and Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker. And those guys, you know, were then the blueprint for hard rock, like Led Zeppelin and Mountain.
Absolutely.
Early heavy metal. So it was just kind of crazy. And then to finish it back over in the USA, Paul Butterfield's blues band released their sophomore album, East West. And that showed that like blues could stretch into long improvisations and psychedelia and jazz and Indian influences. And it foreshadowed psychedelic rock just a few months before the Summer of Love.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So like the Beatles were more artistic that year. The Stones were kind of more dangerous than they'd ever been. And mm-hmm. then like Clapton made guitarists rethink what amplifiers could do. So it was a crazy year for rock like that.
And Levi, can you provide some insight real quick about like the idea of combining a Les Paul with a Marshall and how revolutionary that was?
Well, at the time. So a Les Paul, for those who are listening out there, is a guitar that is a solid hard body guitar that has two humbucker pickups, which essentially would be four single coils. And so no one had really ever taken one of those guitars from the United States over and then plugged it into a very loud Jim Marshall amplifier and all the knobs at 10. and that's the sound of Fresh Cream. And right so on. I'm not doing well enough to describe how like revolutionary it was. It was like a bomb went off in the guitar world. It was the next thing that kind of would have happened would have been Hendrix. And then after Hendrix would have been Van Halen. Those were like the three atomic bombs in guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Good way to put it, man. I also, you know, you mentioned the Stones, Levi. I'll hop back to it for a second because, obviously, everybody talks about Pet Sounds and Revolver from that year. But I really think, you know, while maybe not as groundbreaking as those two albums, and hey, it's all relative, these are all masterpieces.
Right.
So, Aftermath, you know, I think that's a really groundbreaking record for the Stones. You know, I mean, like they go from being, let's be honest, largely a covers band, right? I mean, mostly.
Yeah.
To this absolutely. Aftermath.
I was going to say they were like the best British blues cover band. And like that was like one of their titles. People were like, you want to see the best British cover band? That's the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, this Aftermath is all original compositions. And also, I really think it's Brian Jones's kind of shining moment, you know, in the Stones. He's playing different instruments. You know, you have Paint It Black, which, you know, like they're, you know, that's a really, really original sounding song, you know, with like its sort of almost, you know, Eastern influences on it, you know.
Absolutely.
You would see the Beatles kind of dabble in that as well. But I really think Aftermath needs to be needs to be part of that conversation. And I see kind of like five rock records from that year. And Levi's talked about a couple of them already, or three of them.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. No. I'm not going to go on about them. I'm just going to say that I think these five, in terms of rock, that genre, whatever, you know, there are five albums that kind of really, I would say, set the tone for rock and roll for the next 10 years, essentially. Obviously, Pet Sounds, Revolver, Aftermath, East West, and then also I'll throw Buffalo Springfield's first record in there as well, as really kind of sort of some of the early sounds, along with the Birds, but the Birds didn't have a record in 66. They were, you know, the year before is, you know, kind of the sort of a twangy country, you know, rock sound. So those five to me really stand out as kind of the, and they're by no means in all the greats from that year, but like, you know, those five kind of stand out. It's like, you know, the next 10 years would show people pulling from all five of those albums. You know, you go a little forward, like Levi said, you know, you hear Led Zeppelin, you hear Deep Purple, you hear, you hear prog stuff, right? I mean, which obviously, you know, combine classical music too. So I think that those five really, really stand out and are, I think, are very seminal albums from that year. They set the tone.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we should also want to talk about a little bit that'll segue me into one of the albums that I'm going to highlight, soul music in 1966 was just off the charts, man. Both the two major labels, Motown and Stax, were both, you know, more experimental than, more, you know, more confident in what they were doing.
Yeah.
But they were both like approaching what they were doing from completely different directions.
Yeah.
Motown specialized, you know, in the polish, the precision, the crossover appeal. Songs just even from that year from them were Ain't Too Proud to Beg, You Can't Hurry Love, What Becomes of the Broken Hearted. You know, all those songs feature immaculate arrangements, unforgettable hooks. And then Stax, on the other hand, sounded more like musicians, you know, all together in the same room, sweating in a studio.
There
was less gloss, more grit, more Memphis soul, more river, more humidity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, the variety in 1966, you know, Percy Sledge with When a Man Loves a Woman, Sam and Dave with Hold On, I'm Coming. Lee Dorsey's Working in a Coal Mine was that year, which was the New Orleans jazz producer, Alan Toussaint. That's an Alan Toussaint song, Working in the Coal Mine. And, you know, Bobby Hebb's Sunny, that's a great soul song from that year. But one of the songs and that I'm going to highlight in my favorite from that year is a Stax song, and it's Eddie Floyd's Knock on Wood. Mm. And I want to just spotlight it tonight as my highlight. It was written by Eddie Floyd and Steve Cropper, and it was recorded at Stax in Memphis, and it perfectly captures what made Southern soul different from Motown. You just have to listen to the arrangement, the horn riffs, they grab you instantly. Booker T and the MGs lay down an irresistible groove. Steve Cropper never overplays, really. Every guitar lick serves the song. Eddie Floyd sings with urgency rather than perfection, giving the record a human quality that still jumps out of the speakers 60 years later. And one reason that audiophiles love the recording is because it feels like you're standing in the room with the band in Memphis. There isn't any unnecessary production on it. Every instrument has its own space, and the rhythm section drives it, which is Booker T and the MGs, if you didn't know. Mm-hmm. And so, if you had to define Stax records maybe in one record, it would be real, real, real hard to do. but I might pick Knock on Wood as the perfect choice.
Right on.
Yeah, just a great time for soul music. You know, I wanted to highlight because and I get, I mean, in all fairness, you know, it was a prolific period and many artists at this time would put out more than one record every year. But I think it has to be mentioned, and I'll mention it because Levi's talking about, you know, soul music, R&B. James Brown had 6 releases in 1966.
Ooh, hardest working man.
Yes. And most like a lot of those, the label he was working with most closely at the time seemed to be a label called Smash, was the label that was releasing most of his records like in the mid 60s.
Okay.
He'd then go on to King Record and then he'd go on to Polydor. But yeah, so he's got James Brown plays New Breed, the Boogaloo, right? And then he's got It's a Man's Band's World, which is probably the most well-known one. Well, that and I Got You, I Feel Good comes out at 66 as well. He releases a great Mighty Instrumentals album, Handful of Soul, and then also, hey, what year would be complete without a Christmas album, right? So, you know, six albums. Again, are they kind of like, you know, all, you know, what I want to say here? I mean, some are kind of, you know, there's an instrumental and stuff, but still 6 LPs in 1 year is insane. Obviously people were gobbling up his tunes then. You know, he has such a fantastic band. And, you know, also he was a writer that wasn't a musician, you know, I mean, he wasn't trained, you know, like, I mean, he was all like, he just hadn't like, you know, he just picked up on the rhythm of life. You know, I know it's kind of a cheesy way to put it, but he, you know, he was all clicks and snaps and, you know what I mean? Like he had to mouth everything to the band, you know, and, and that's how he wrote. And, it's just, if there's a single star of 1966, I've got to give the award to him because I think arguably, you know, this is his best period, like 65 to 68, you know, right around right. there.
Yeah, for sure. He's in his Ron Santo era.
Yes.
Ron Santo was in his James Brown era, however you'd like to phrase it.
Lockstep. Yeah.
Absolutely. So JB's just, he's on fire. I mean, it's just, he's on another level, you know, at this time. And like I said, his band is just, his band just smokes. I mean, they're just unreal. They're so tight on all these records. So yeah, I gave all of these a listen and loved every one of them. So what a year for JB, a landmark year for him.
For sure.
Yeah. Jonathan, any albums to you that stand out during that year that like we haven't touched on?
No, just the Kinks released that year.
Yeah.
Yep. Face to face.
Yeah. Face to face. Yeah.
Great album.
Yeah.
And, you know, just a sign that they were kind of hitting on all cylinders, even that early. And for a band that who's, you know, decade that I like the most is the next decade. So just to show that they weren't afraid.
No, absolutely
and,
not.
Yeah. I think Ray Davies showing early on that he wasn't afraid to take chances. And one of the more underrated songwriters in the history of rock and roll.
Amen. Amen to that. Great choice there. I'll pluck out a couple more within the soul genre to stick that for a second. Percy Sledge's Warm and Tender Soul is outstanding from that year. Nina Simone has Wild as the Wind, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
well,
that was really good. Yeah.
Otis Redding's got the complete and unbelievable Otis Redding, right? The Dictionary, you know, which is another great one. Lou Rawls, Solon is a really great record. I can't believe I have mentioned it. The Temptations, you know, come out with, they're still putting out some of their best work, right? You know, Getting Ready comes out that year. Four Tops on Top comes out that year. you know, I think Jonathan had mentioned it, or maybe Levi mentioned it. Sam and Dave's, I think their first record, Hold On, I'm Coming, comes out that year.
Yeah.
So, man, you know, Isley Brothers, right?
Bangers, part of mine.
Yeah. I mean, Martha the Vandellas, like, it's just Stevie Wonder, Uptight. Jesus Christ. Like, I can't even name, like, we'd be here all night naming outstanding soul records, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a golden era of that period. And I love it all. And, you know, That's Moods of Marvin Gaye comes out that year. Like, you know, that was stuff that, you know, growing up, obviously I would gravitate towards those five records that I mentioned, you know, with Aftermath, Revolver and whatever, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I wasn't cool enough to listen to all the ones I just rattled off. But now It's like, Jesus Christ, man, there's just,
somewhat related was Them Again album. With Van Morrison. And I had stumbled upon that recently just by coincidence, because I had heard their cover of It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, Bob Dylan's song. And I had heard it in a film and didn't realize that Beck had sampled that tune for one of his songs off of Odelay called Jackass. Mm-hmm. And so that that got me going down a bit of a rabbit hole to find this tune. And yeah, sure enough, 1966, Them Again. If you listen to It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, I mean, the sound on that, I didn't think twice that Beck would have created that sound, because it was a very Odelay sound. But little did I know in 1990, whatever, six, when Odelay came out, that that sound was 30 years old.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. And again, you know, that's great. Great pick there. There's almost too many to name, but I'll rattle off a few more. 96 Tears comes out that year, right? Which, you know, one of the best singles, I think. This is one of the strongest, the title track being one of the strongest singles of that year.
One I want to mention before we forget, just in case you don't highlight it, is The Who, A Quick One, their song.
Yeah, right. You know, they released their
the first little taste of a rock opera. Yeah,
right.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another one, a debut, right? I mean, because, you know, a lot of these artists that we mentioned had a couple albums under their belt at this point. It's the Small Faces first record comes out this year as well. Which, you know, I think, you know, maybe they're kind of still finding their voice, but it's an outstanding record, you know, and you know, the arrival of that group and how important they would become to a lot of the bands that I think the three of us listen to. So without saying, one of the things that's really exciting about this era too, is, you know, what was to come afterwards, like what this year influenced, you know, 1966, a teenage Tom Petty is listening to the radio a lot. Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? Like, this is, he's taken from all this. Right.
And he hears 8 Miles High or Mr. Space.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, a younger John Mellencamp is listening to this, and he's thinking about, you know, how, you know, he's listening to the soul albums as well. Right. And how he can weave that into his own musical journey there. So it's so exciting, because all the people that I love so much as musicians, you know, they were hearing this stuff as teenagers, and it really, you know, it was very,
And even for just like the next few years, how it would shape the next, you know, the immediate future. And that's what I think is so interesting about 66 or even 65, 67 is how we have the benefit of thinking of it in context of like what came before and what came after. And yeah, I was at the beginning of the episode. I was kind of poking at the music critics at the time, or the other musicians at the time, who had negative reactions to some of what we consider, you know, the greatest that rock has to offer now. And it just makes you wonder, you know, nobody's immune to doing that. And it makes you wonder what we're overlooking now that 10 or 20 or 30 years from now, they'll be like, how did you guys not recognize this at the time? And so, but yeah, 66 is a perfect year for viewing in that context.
Yeah. I'll mention a couple other guys, and you guys can throw in some too, that I think deserve maybe a little more love, right? Not that they're not important albums and people don't talk about them. For one, I think Sunshine Superman is a really great record that year. I don't think Donovan often gets the respect that he deserves. You know, obviously people, you know, they kind of build him up. This is the British Dylan, you know. And, you know, he always had to kind of, you know, hear that, which I'm sure was frustrating and probably probably diminished his reputation in a lot of people's eyes, unfairly, of course. But, you know, you've got a young John Paul Jones and Jimmy Page playing on Sunshine Superman, right? As well. Mm-hmm. So he's got, you know, there's some big names that played on that record. And that song, you know, that song shot, the title track shot to number one in the U.S. And, you know, I was listening to it. It was probably a tune I hadn't listened to in years. And it's just such an infectious song, you know. And it's so good, and it got me, you know, next thing you know, I'm looking up Donovan documentaries I want to watch. I got to put a Donovan book on hold at the library, you know, and all that, because I don't know, Jonathan, like, I know she's not here. Betsy seems like a person that would really like Donovan. Your wife.
Oh,
I don't know if she does.
100%. Okay,
all right. Yeah. I figured as much. Yeah. Yeah. I thought, like, I bet Betsy likes Donovan and a couple others. So that's one I think deserves, you know, a little more respect than it gets, maybe. A couple others. I really think The Hums of the Lovin' Spoonful is a really fun record from that year. I think all of Paul Revere and the Raiders, they put out a couple that year, I think are really, really fun albums as well. And I also like, there's a band from Chicago. Obviously, they played this cover kind of straight up. So maybe they don't get a lot of creativity points, but there's a band from Chicago called The Shadows of Night. And they, you know, they probably do the most popular cover of them's Gloria, right?
Because do you know the story?
Of The Shadows of Night? Mm-mm.
So the reason why was because them got banned on U.S. radio. And so a band in the U.S., multiple bands, I think, covered it, trying to catch it and have the hit here with it. And theirs was the biggest.
Huh.
Yeah. It's mostly covers, you know, that album, but it's a fun kind of, you know, garage rocky album that again, it's mostly covers, but it's a really good listen. And just a couple others that I'll mention that you know, with it was a really good time for jazz as well. It was an experimental time. Like, you had really, I think, kind of the beginnings of free jazz, which I know free jazz isn't everybody's cup of tea, and it will test the patience of some listeners. But, you know, you had John Coltrane's Ascension come out that year in 66. Ornette Coleman, right, had a record come out in 66. And then also Cecil Taylor's Unit Structures, right? So jazz was going, I think, in some pretty bold directions at that time that was divisive. And, but it would, you know, the albums from this year of the jazz albums from 66 would pave the way for, you know, albums like Bitches Brew, for the fusion explosion that would happen, you know, in the early 70s. So yeah, important time for that as well. Levi, I wanted to ask you this. Are there any country albums you like from this year?
Oh, I didn't even really think about that. Wow.
There's some good ones, dude.
There are a few Waylon albums.
I bet there are. I don't know enough years in my head.
Yeah.
I'll pull up some notes real fast.
Yeah, I mean, all three of us probably listen to 70s country and 80s country, right? Hearing it on the radio, growing more. But I really like Connie Smith's Mrs. Smith Goes to Nashville. For this album, or for this year, I think it's really strong. I just, you know, I like the production. She was like putting out like 2-3 albums a year. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also Statler Brothers, Flowers on the Wall, their first record.
Okay.
Comes out that year as well. So those two, and there's some other good ones. I don't have time to mention them all, but those two kind of stand out to me as two of my favorite country albums from that year, or two country albums that I like a lot, at least. A
couple of Johnny Paycheck records that year.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
Short-haired, clean-cut Johnny Paycheck. I don't, like, you know what I mean? Like, I
he was like still Waylon, popping enough pills. Just people didn't know.
Right. Waylon, Waylon and Johnny too. Paycheck would look dramatically different. Like,
Johnny Cash, Waylon, and Johnny all three of those guys were just pill heads.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But You Ain't Woman Enough, Loretta Lynn. That's maybe one of the top ones. That's a great album from that year.
Yeah. I enjoyed listening.
One I have to mention, just because Illinois Connection. I think the band technically is from Keokuk, Iowa, which is the border, right?
Mm-hmm.
The band is called Gone, G-O-N-N. They were a psych garage rock band that were on the original Nuggets compilation. And they had their big hit in 1966 is called Blackout of Greetly, G-R-E-T-E-L-Y, Blackout of Greetly. And it's this like just psych garage rock little pop piece of perfectness. The song opens with this psychedelic line, "The universe is permeated with the odor of kerosene." And then it's like,
why not?
Gang. It's like all garage rock guitars. But they made their way onto a Nuggets compilation by that first one was done by, wasn't it Lenny Kaye, I believe?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. My old swimming buddy, Lenny Kaye.
Yeah.
I hung out at a pool with Lenny Kaye and his wife one day.
I would say that's the rest of my life. Yeah,
I don't remember the details.
I would lead every story with
that. Don't what you hung out you told me this, but the details are hazy.
Yeah, tell the listener. Right. What do we got here?
Last August we went to San Diego for a little symposium called Tiki Oasis, and it's a few days of appreciating the present culture and past of tiki and there's a lot of music,
the love
involved.
Of like umbrella drinks and like wooden statues, any of that kind you're talking, right?
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Nice. And there were performances every night, live music, every night. And on the final night, Lenny Kaye performed, and while our flight left before his performance earlier in the stay, I was just down at the hotel pool hanging out with this long-haired dude who looks like kind of looked like our buddy Michael Davis, and but this dude's like, you know, older, and then I was later told that was Lenny Kaye. I was like, oh cool, I had no idea. We were just down at the pool together for an hour.
Nice.
Right on.
Only known. Wow. Well, yeah. Well, and I mean,
had I known, I would have had him on the podcast.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Drop him our card next time. Well, that puts a good bow on it. A nice Lenny Kaye story to end it. Lenny working on the backstroke.
I thought it was going to get crazy, because I know like tiki drinks can get wild quick. You can only drink like a half a drink, or not just one drink of a. Some
I know
of those
my
tiki
limits.
Drinks have like 14 shots in them and stuff.
The good ones have a nice balance, but no, I know my limits, and whatever party Lenny was at in the evenings, I wasn't there. It was just nice to be in his presence, however briefly.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Nice. Well, good stuff, guys, and a lot of fun, and such an important year in pop music. And really all genres of music. So like to thank everybody for listening. You can check us out, all of our episodes. You can get them at rockchew.com. You can listen to this episode on your favorite podcast app or on Spotify. And follow us on Instagram at Rockin' Chew. We'll probably need to do a little more posting. We'll do that. And hope everybody is having a great summer so far. And we look forward to seeing you again, hopefully soon. Thanks and good night.